Direction point! Direction point!
A Doctor Who Podcast Network.
Well, hi everybody! Welcome back to Doctor Who Literature, the podcast taking you to the world of the Doctor Who novelizations put out by Target Books from 1973 onward in publication order. We're a member of the Direction Point Doctor Who Podcast Network. My name is Jason, and I'm your host on this journey, this very long journey. Today, we are looking at book number 90 in the Target series. Yes, we have made it as far as book 90. We are more than halfway through the original Target run. We are looking at The Highlanders by Jerry Davis, televised in December 1966 and January 1967. We are going a long way back. Speaking of a long way back, this past weekend, the weekend when I released episode 89, Inferno, with David Barsky, I also celebrated my 50th birthday. The actual birthday is a little bit further down the calendar, but occurs the same weekend as my daughter's bat mitzvah. So in order to make sure that each important event gets equal shrift, I moved my birthday a little bit up the calendar. The event took place at a landmark hotel in New York City. We had a total of 25 guests. One of the guests was Graham Burke from the Reality Bomb podcast and a frequent contributor to this program. And Graham got me a phenomenal 50th birthday present. It is, in fact, an American Avon paperback copy of Doctor Who in an Exciting Adventure with the Daleks, which was covered all the way back on episode 1 of this program in November 2021, before the show had acquired its current format, before I had any guests. It is a red and blue cover with Doctor Who in regular font with a drop shadow, but not in any of the typical logos. And there are what appears to be a photo illustration of model Daleks attacking a couple of actors playing Ian and Barbara. The back of the cover says, "The Daleks have arrived. Free. Free." He thought when he woke in the strange machine that had whisked him away from his despair on Earth, but the flight through space had ended, and he and the hollow-eyed girl he found by his side were strangling in the poisoned air they swallowed with every breath, and around them lay a world of ashes, controlled by a hidden city of monstrous machines. To sleep on Earth and awaken to interplanetary horror. And have you also read the most talked about bestseller of love, marriage, and crime? The Detective is here. 95 cents. Avon, the sign of good reading. Inside the book is essentially the text of the David Whittaker novelization, except that the quotation marks have been changed to the American rather than the British format. The edges of the paperback are tinted red, which was common back in the 60s, but you don't really see that anymore. And on the inside cover, Mike Morgan has signed his name, Room 6. Mike Morgan was also the name of a baseball player who pitched for a total of 12 different baseball teams over 4 decades, starting his career with the pitiful Oakland A's of the late 1970s, then winding up winning a World Series with the Arizona Diamondbacks in 2001. It seems unlikely that this is the same Mike Morgan, but hey, if you are Mike Morgan, who pitched for the Yankees in 1982, and is a listener of this podcast, and this is your book, drop me a line, buddy. I also received from my friend Florence, a fellow lawyer in New York City who is not a Doctor Who fan, a remarkable, oversized bound volume called Star Wars, a chronicle from the pages of the New York Times. It is a compilation of New York Times articles about Star Wars, the movie franchise, between 1976 and 2022. The very first article is entitled, "From American Graffiti to Outer Space, and it was published in the Sunday Times on September 12th, 1976. Yes, that is 8 months before Star Wars had its premiere in Los Angeles. There is a black and white photo of Luke and Han in stormtrooper costumes escorting Chewbacca in the prisoner gambit. The editor of that section of the Times in 1976, or whoever typed the photo caption, clearly was not aware what was happening in universe or who any of these figures were. Two robots and their captives in Star Wars, directed by American Graffiti's George Lucas. The article itself is interesting because, remember, this is written from long ago when George Lucas was a hot young director coming off the success of American Graffiti, but Star Wars obviously was a long way from becoming the multi-billion dollar phenomenon that it is. The first paragraph, "Right now, I'm contemplating retirement," said George Lucas. A polite laugh seemed the best answer. With the dazzling success of American Graffiti, his comic and touching portrait of 50s teenagers, still fresh in everyone's mind, and by the way, this article is so old that the word teenagers is still hyphenated, and in the middle of shooting Star Wars, a $6.5 million space adventure spectacular for 20th Century Fox, the idea of one of America's hottest directors renouncing fame and fortune at 32 sounded, well, whimsical. And the final paragraph, with that, George Lucas excused himself and returned to the set for another session of laser beams, Arabian Nights, and intergalactic escapism. So on the whole, I had a remarkable time turning 50, and this is a wonderful bookend pair of presents. The book that I've read a dozen times, but in an edition that I do not own, and with absolutely striking cover design and blurbs. And then a compilation of New York Times articles about Star Wars, which I have never read. Well, some of these I would have read, especially the back half of the book, which covers primarily the more recent prequel and sequel trilogies. But I'm certainly excited about reading the earlier coverage from the 1970s and 80s, which was before I started reading the Times. Giving another shout-out, of course, to friend of the podcast, James Kure Smith, who continues to crush it with his psychic paper, Substack. On September 8th, he published an ode to Season 8, John Pertwee's second season. We are unfortunately nearly done with Season 8 on Doctor Who Literature. Of the five stories, four of the novelizations are already in the past, in publication order, as far as this podcast is concerned. In terms of our back catalog, you can listen to older episodes that you might not have heard. Terror of the Autons we covered all the way back in episode 14. Claws of Axos we covered in episode 31. Colony in Space, which was novelized as The Doomsday Weapon, was episode 6. And The Demons was covered back in episode 8. That was the first appearance of Cy Hart on this show, but of course, certainly not the last. You will be hearing Cy again very, very soon, I promise. Very happy to have Daniel Knight back. This is a slightly shorter interview than usual because of the time frame involved and our respective schedules. Mine has certainly been very, very hectic over the last 6 weeks and is not going to be easing up anytime over the next month, but I am committed to bringing you a weekly show. So Daniel and I did speak for 40 minutes. Not quite as long as some of my other interviews, but we certainly covered a lot of ground in those 40 minutes, and I'm very happy to have you hear them. So, let's get to it.
Hello, fellow time travelers, and welcome to the Doctor Who Target Book Club podcast, the only podcast to discuss, in story order, all the Doctor Who novelizations. My name is Tony Whitt, and every 2 weeks or so, I'm joined by a 2 to 3 person discussion panel, including our so-called expert who's been a Who fan since 1979. That would be me. We also get the views of intermediate, casual, and novice fans who either have never seen the show or who have never read these books until these podcasts, including
Dalton Hughes
and
Allison Fitz-Seyfried.
You can find us on iTunes, Stitchers, or wherever you find good podcasts, or even ones like ours. You're listening to the Doctor Who Literature Podcast, Enjoy your travels.
All right, Daniel Nye, welcome back to Doctor Who Literature, my friend. Haven't spoken to you in a while.
No, the last time we spoke, there was still a 13th Doctor, although there will always be a 13th Doctor, but it was just before we were about to say goodbye to her in The Power of the Doctor, I seem to remember.
We are up to 15 now. 14 will be, or Boteen, as they call him, will be on TV in a few weeks, and then 15 probably next spring, from what I understand.
Christmas and then next spring, yes.
We are approaching the 60th anniversary, so what I've been doing lately is I want to ask you, before we start talking about this week's book, considering all of the canonical TV stories, Unearthly Child, November 1963, all the way through Power of the Doctor, October 2022, what is your favorite TV story of all time and why?
That's an impossible question, because today I will say it's City of Death, tomorrow I'll say it's The Five Doctors or Remembrance of the Daleks. If it goes by the amount of times I've watched a particular story, I would have to say it's The Five Doctors. I know it's not the best Doctor Who story ever.
See, I had done a two-part episode on why Five Doctors has a claim for being the greatest of all time. I don't think it's fair to go by most times watched, because it's going to be very hard for the new series to win for many of us who started watching the classic series in the 20th century. So I'm going to go with the very first story you named. Why would City of Death be your favorite, at least on this particular day?
It's just joyous. I mean, everyone is at the top of their game. And if you think about it, it was a rush script written over a weekend. It was a rushed production with at least only sort of 3 or 4 days in Paris, where they were just basically running from location to location. It wasn't glamorous. It was pouring with rain. Poor old Lala Ward must have been freezing in that schoolgirl uniform. Julian Glover's always moaned that he never got to go to Paris. But it's fantastic. Julian Glover is one of my favorite actors. He's more of a Bond villain in this than he is in his actual James Bond film. The music, I mean, Dudley Simpson just really soars. And I know, because obviously it's one of your favorites, because it's the music you use to introduce this podcast.
So yes, you're exactly right.
Yeah. And just as somebody said, just when you think it doesn't get any better, John Cleese and Eleanor Bron turn up. So I know John Cleese is a bit of a divisive figure nowadays, but it was Basil Fawlty turning up in Doctor Who. So, yeah, it's just marvellous.
Well, everybody's a divisive figure nowadays. They just announced that, confirming a long-boiling rumour, that Miriam Margolyes is going to be the voice of Beep the Meep. Speaking of divisive figures, I guess RTD enjoys casting divisive figures whenever he can. This is the same person who put Sharon Osbourne and Anne Whittacombe on Doctor Who. But going back to 1979, I think John Cleese was the perfect choice for a cameo, and he just plays that little deadpan role so well. It's enjoyable, no matter how grumpy old man he may be today in 2023, and he certainly is grumpy.
He is, yeah. I mean, some of the things he complains about, I can understand. But yeah, sometimes it's a bit like, you know, Angry Man shouts at cloud. Yeah.
He was in Miami last year, the same week that I was in Miami. And the day I arrived, it was a rainy, overcast day, not your classic Miami, Florida weather. And he immediately took to Twitter about how unfortunate it was that he went to Miami when the weather was bad. And he decided to put this on his public Twitter feed. He went to the hotel spa for a massage. And I think he was upset because he had to show proof of identification in order to get into the spa, which kind of puts him in do you know who I am territory, which is never where you want to be when you're famous.
So I never thought I would do this in a million years when I was a kid being raised on his comedy. I just cracked back at him on Twitter. Dude, they're there to massage your spine, not your ego. But he had so many similar responses that he didn't see that.
Yes.
I will say that on my all-time 60 for 60 list, which I recorded at LI Who, in which I broadcast a portion of on this show a while back, City of Death is high atop my top 60, so you and I are in good company.
Mm-hmm. So where would the Highlanders fit in your... I'm guessing it's probably not in your 60 for 60.
I had to make some interesting choices, and I'll do a separate episode with my entire top 60 in November, but I had to make some choices because I couldn't include every historical, right? And I couldn't include every William Hartnell Dalek story. I didn't want to get repetitive. So some stories on my top 60 are there to speak for other stories. So like the massacre is there to speak for all the serious historicals. Before I did my top 60, though, I did a semifinals where I just went through the entire episode guide and I clicked off all the stories that I really, really loved. And I ended up with 99 stories in my top 60. And then I had to whittle down. The Highlanders was not in my top 99, but I've called you here today because you have been developing an expertise in Scotland and the Highlanders. So I wanted to turn over the rest of our time to you because you have recently traveled there, I believe.
Well, I have to say it's not the first time I've been to the battlefield. Many years ago, I would have been about sort of 14, 15, because my grandparents are from Scotland. My dad was born in Aberdeenshire, and we went there. It was a sort of like a spring holiday, Easter holidays. So end of March, beginning of April. My parents lived in a place called Turriff, which is about 60, 70 miles away from the battlefield. So it was going to be a long journey. We left Turriff in brilliant sunshine. Halfway there, it started snowing. When we arrived at the battlefield, it was a blizzard. There was sort of like this sort of single road track leading up to the visitor centre, which wasn't open. And there was these two people, I think, were setting up for the holiday season, you know, peering through the window going, who are these idiots driving up here in this blizzard? But fortunately, when we went this year, the weather was much better. And it's like all battlefields, there's sort of like an eerie quietness to it. I mean, it's not a huge area, but it is, I mean, it's beautiful countryside. And the battlefield itself is, it's not something that's taught in English history lessons in schools. But I imagine that it is in Scottish schools. But the book does actually briefly give, on page 10, it gives a brief précis of the battle and the leading up to it of why the battle took place with the two sides of the army, the two sides of the battle with the Duke of Cumberland. A lot of people think it's an England versus Scotland battle, but there were actually Scots on both sides. It's a misnomer that it was just English versus Scots. There were Scots on both sides, and indeed Jerry Davis, when he does mention it, he says King George and his supporters soon rounded up an army of English and German regiments, and even a number of Scottish troops loyal to King George, who did not like the prospect of another erratic Stuart king, a Scottish king, on the throne. And many years ago, in my former job, I was given a guide to the book, to the Battle of Culloden. And the battle was over and done with within an hour. And it's quite a bloody battle. It really was not the nicest or happiest time in English or Scottish British history. The battle was bloody, and thousands of people, even those who were sort of, you know, innocently, in the villages around, the Duke of Cumberland, who headed up the English side, the English forces, just basically told his soldiers to just let rip and just shoot and kill everybody that they saw. So when we look in, when we read in the Highlanders, because unfortunately we can't see it, we can have the audio to it. It's it's extremely unlikely that when the Doctor and Ben and Jamie and the Laird are captured in episode one, that they'd just be sort of captured. They would have been butchered in real life, to be honest. But there we are.
A few points in favor of the Highlanders. It's a story where you have Ben and Polly, who are 20th century English. And when they arrive, they immediately assume that the British are the good guys and that they're going to be safe with the Redcoats rather than with the quote-unquote rebels. And, of course, the story quickly disabuses them of that notion. Although we do see some Scottish figures who are quick to betray the cause in favor of leniency, and we do see a fairly sympathetic British officer. So the story does try to show the whole spectrum of opinions. One of the reasons why it's not in my top 60 or even my top 99 is, and I'll talk about this more in the audio essay, you have this weird divide where episode one is pretty gritty, and they show up not during the battle, but at the end of the battle when the survivors are being mopped up and, as you say, slaughtered. And then it quickly devolves into Marx Brothers-esque farce with Patrick Troughton trying on a different costume and accent in every episode and more interested in hats than he is in historical injustice. There's probably a way to tell the story the way that Outlander did, but the script doesn't quite seem to know what it wants to do with this story. And it doesn't help that we don't have the direction. I mean, we know that Hugh David did a phenomenal job directing Fury from the Deep for the following season. We just don't know what he would have made of this weird mix of brutal historical tragedy versus Patrick Troughton farce. It might be helpful if we had more than a few surviving seconds from part one. And what we have from part one seems pretty uncompromising, but we don't have any of the clownish stuff from parts two, three, and four. So that might help. And then for a farcical story, the primary villain is played so straight and so mild that he doesn't really quite stand out on the pantheon of the great human villains of the Troughton era. It's not exactly Joseph First in The Underwater Menace, the following story, is he now?
No. I think it might have been Jason Thompson who described it as really it should be called Doctor Who and the Very Stern Solicitor. But I mean, there are sort of quite some, you know, colourful characters. You've got Algernon, the British officer, who's sort of a bit of a silly upper class twit of a soldier. You've got Perkins, the sort of the beleaguered clerk, who's the Doctor sort of takes advantage of. You've got Trask, who's the full on pirate. You know, you can just imagine that he's sort of doing his full on Robert Newton impression. Yes, you swab. And in amongst this, you've got the character of Jamie, who doesn't really make that much of an impression, but for some reason Innes Lloyd looked at this character and thought we could have him on board. And that's not to say that Fraser Hines gives a bad performance. He doesn't, but it seems very strange that they decided to take him on. I think there's probably more to it than we realize. I don't know whether the production team weren't very happy with Michael Kreyes. There were rumors about that, I think, which is a shame because I think both he and Annika Wills work so well together. And it's quite nice at the beginning when they work, you know, it's just the two of them with the Doctor. And I noticed on the first page, and this is something that Jerry Davis writes again in Tomb of the Cybermen, sort of something similar, when they're Polly and Ben are looking around and, you know, trying to guess where they are. It says it towards the bottom of page 7. Behind them, the Doctor looked around, drawing his own conclusions, but as usual, said nothing. He liked to have his young companions make up their own minds about the various strange locations the TARDIS arrived in. And I like that. It seems to be because Jerry Davis was one of sort of the instigators of the Second Doctor. So I think they were sort of looking to see that this would be, unlike William Hartnell's Doctor, this would be a Doctor who would not necessarily be as authoritarian as Hartnell. He'd be a bit more letting, you know, giving his companions a bit more leeway into to working out where they are and what they could do.
And it's something you certainly see throughout Annika Wills' time on the show in The Smugglers, which was her first full story, her first trip in the TARDIS. As soon as they land in Cornwall, she immediately figures out where they are. And then, following production season, Underwater Menace, she again figures out where they are, only this time it turns out that she's incorrect and they're nowhere near Cornwall for a second time. But it does seem to have been a character trait that they were consciously working into the show. Polly's the one who figures out where they are and when, what's going on.
Yeah. And some fans complain about Perry and Tegan in the 80s not wanting to be where they are. But Ben often is the one who's complaining about, oh, can we just get back to the TARDIS and let's get out of here? Where this is actually a very good story for Polly and for Ben as well. He sort of stands up to the scenes towards the end, where he's standing up to Trask and the solicitor, Gray by name, Gray by nature, I think. but Polly's, she's quite resourceful in this. They give her sort of a companion of her own in Kirsty, played by a young Hannah Gordon. And she's quite manipulative and able to sort of take advantage of Algernon. So it's a good story for Polly, I think.
And the novelization certainly seems to think so, because Davis is always pointing out where Polly's pluck and adventurous nature is helping out the plot, and she influences Kirsty to act more like her. So yes. Kirsty starts off in one place and then quickly evolves to another, to the extent where you can reasonably think that Kirsty is going to join the TARDIS crew at the end, because Jamie's character development is pretty flat. Although Jamie does have this cool stunt in part 4 where he's implied to swing from a rope across the deck of the ship and kick Captain Trask over into the Firth, not to be seen again until Alien Bodies in 1997.
I haven't read Alien Bodies. So they dug up Trask, did they? Well,
it is unique in 1990s Doctor Who novels that it resurrects two different villains from the Troughton era. But there's the whole faction paradox thing going on. So Trask has been somewhat subtly altered from his performance in The Highlanders. His memories of the story have changed. And it becomes quite the unreliable narrator, but it's definitely the same Trask.
Okay. Wow, of all the characters to bring back, he's not really the one I would think of.
There is a theory that in his first book, Christmas on a Rational Planet, which came out in 1996, Miles worked in a continuity reference to every single televised Doctor Who story. Then sometimes it was an overt reference, sometimes it was a continuity pun, sometimes it was an oblique. Like, there's a character who appears on one page of the book, Christmas on a Rational Planet, whose name is Lincoln. And that's a reference to The Chase, because Lincoln appears in The Chase. Right. I haven't actually sat down with a grid, but I think he does the same thing again in Alien Bodies, because Alien Bodies has references or jokes about everything. So Trask is there, and Trask is more of a tertiary villain in Alien Bodies, but he's standing in for the Highlanders.
Right.
When did you first acquire your copy of the novelization?
I don't know if it was the same holiday, but I actually bought this, or it was bought for me, by my great aunt and uncle, Auntie Jimmy and Uncle Betty, and they took my sister and my two sisters and I out for the day. We were staying with them, and they were just to give my parents a bit of a rest. So we went to a place called Elgin, which is not far away from Inverness, about 20 miles from the battlefield itself. So this is one of the few Doctor Who books I have that was bought fairly close to where it's set. Yes, my twin sister got some Lego, my younger sister got a Barbie doll, and I just always remember that we sort of spent longer to look for a Doctor Who book for me to be bought for me, and when we found this one it was very appropriate. But I don't know, you you've had said some story, sort of tales about how Doctor Who books and where you found them and where you bought them. I forgot to say last time when we did Robots of Death, that was actually bought for me in Harrods. But I've only ever been to Harrods twice in my life. And that one time when I was a lot younger, that was when I had the Robots of Death bought for me.
I was at Harrods once during our first family trip to London in 2018. I did not buy any Doctor Who books at Harrods, but later that same trip, we took the Underground all the way out to the Who shop, and that's where I purchased my Target novelization copy of City of Death, the James Goss paperback cut down.
Yeah.
My copy of The Highlanders was purchased Long Island, New York in 1985, so it certainly was not purchased anywhere near the Highlands of Scotland. Now, my mother's older sister did a family vacation to Scotland in 1985, and she brought me back an authentic wool sweater, which then got shrunk in the wash, so I only got to wear it a couple of times before it became unwearable. But I should have had her find Doctor Who stuff for me to buy in Scotland, but I didn't think to ask.
No. You could have bought her some McCrimmon tartan. She could have bought that back for you. I don't know. It's sort of red, isn't it? The tartan they use for Jamie.
You know, that same trip, she actually purchased a hardcover coffee table book doing all the tartans for all the clans. And I actually found the McCrimmons in that book when I was reading it, one long weekend stuck at her house in New Jersey. So this was, many, many, many years ago, and she passed away in 2015. So I have no idea if the book is still in family possession. But I have cross-checked the Highlanders in a book about Highland tartans that my aunt purchased.
I think tartan, or certainly kilts, were banned by the Duke of Cumberland after the Battle of Culloden. So it was you weren't yeah they weren't allowed to wear tartan for a while. But it soon came back into fashion.
I have heard that. I will say that growing up in the States, our history never quite got as far as 1746. I mean, we had the broad outlines of English history and European history, but mostly it was focusing on things that happened in the 50 states. Mm-hmm. So basically all that I know about this, the 1746 Culloden, the Jacobite uprising, would come from Doctor Who, the Highlanders. And it's helpful that Jerry Davis, I don't know how authentic the history is because I'm not an expert, but it has the ring of authenticity. And he's definitely talking to the younger reader as he writes the book. It's sort of a history lesson in progress, even as he's telling the story. So for me, the book actually works better than TV episodes because the book does a better job of smoothing out this weird disconnect between dark tragedy and a cross-dressing comical farce, which we see with the Troughton Doctor midway through the story.
Yeah. I mean, the brief piece of history that Davis puts in at the beginning of the book is from what I can tell, is fairly accurate. And it is a nice sort of thing because it even to us, it isn't a well-known piece of history. I mean, it's well known to me because I have a Scottish father, but a lot of my contemporaries and a lot of children wouldn't have even heard of the Battle of Culloden, probably, which is a shame, really, because it's part of our history, part of our heritage.
And speaking of heritage, there is the long-running TV series based on the series of novels, Outlander, which, this is not a secret, began life kind of sort of as off-license Doctor Who fan fiction, because that was inspired by the author watching the War Games on PBS in the States and definitely plucking the character of Jamie and possibly plucking the character of Lady Jennifer, the ambulance driver, as well, and spinning her own unique story about that, beginning with Culloden in 1746.
Yeah, and hence why the main character is called Jamie Fraser.
Yes, and then Fraser Hines himself had a cameo in a episode of the series that I have not yet seen.
Ah, yes, he plays a prison governor, I believe. So, and not as heroic as Jamie is. I have to say the picture of him on the front cover of the book is a really good picture. It's a striking cover. I just wish they could have found a different picture of the TARDIS, because that seems to be sort of a similar picture to the, of the TARDIS that it's on the Aztecs only a few books before that. But and some would say that's probably not the right TARDIS anyway, because it looks like sort of the one they use for the mid-Tom Baker era.
Yeah, the shade of blue is a little too bright, although the light is flashing and it appears to be in mid-dematerialization because you can see the background behind it. So that may be taking a cue from the Mythmakers cover a few books earlier where the TARDIS is in mid-materialization. Yes. And I think that's William Dysart standing behind Jamie. And from the first 20 pages of the book, you figure that his character is going to be the main character. And of course, he's brutally killed off partway through episode one.
Indeed. Which, if we ever do find the films or the videotapes for the Highlanders, will come as a shock to fans of Dysart from his performance in the Androids Ambassadors of Death. He's so good in that. It's a real nasty, believable villain. Not the usual. sometimes villains in Doctor Who can be a little bit on the camp side, but he's a really sort of nasty piece of work, and I'm very believable about it.
Yeah, 3 points about William Dysart's character in Ambassadors. Number one, it's a wonderful performance. And in fact, even after he's captured and he capitulates to the authorities, he's still giving advice and asking for clemency. He's just one of these, you know, long John Silver bad guy types who's always trying to get on your good side no matter what. So I love his performance. Secondly, Rob Shearman and Toby Haydock in the first Running Through Corridors book talk about how that character was probably an influence on the Master, because the production team wanted a humanoid foil for the Doctor, the bad guy, opposite unit. And they believe that his performance in episodes 3 through 7 of Ambassadors is the inspiration. And my third point about William Dysart is as follows. My outro music is from the Ambassadors of Death. You pointed out that City of Death is my intro, but my outro is William Dysart in the Ambassadors of Death. I love that Dudley Simpson score. So there's a little bit of William Dysart in every episode of the show that I've ever recorded.
There we go. Obviously, Dudley Simpson is inspired when there's the word death in the title, because that's Ambassadors of Death is also one of my favorite Dudley Simpson scores. It's so good, and it's just such a shame that the following season he goes all radiophonic and uses the synthesizers. But there we go.
Yeah, there's so many. There's that moody outer space score in Ambassadors, and then there's the harpsichord and flute unit theme. It's terrific work by Dudley.
And also the action scene, the music they use for when Liz Shaw's being chased while she's chasing Bessie, while she's driving in Bessie. That's a pretty good, exciting cliffhanger as well, and some really good sort of mood music.
I'm still more than half a year away from getting to Ambassadors on this show, but I will say that I've lined up one of my favorite people of all time to be the guest for Ambassadors, because that is a story that I feel very, very strongly about. I was championing Ambassadors on Rec Arts Doctor Who in the early 90s before it was considered cool. And now that Ambassadors is considered cool again, I'm kind of proud of being the one who got there first. So I will be defending that story vigorously when the time comes.
It was one that I came rather late to, because I didn't have UK Gold as a lot of other fans. It was the channel that Doctor Who was repeated on over here. So I waited until it came out on VHS in the early 2000s, and I was blown away by it. I thought this isn't the story that everyone was saying. You know, a little bit dull and boring and complicated. I loved it. Yeah.
Other points about Highlanders then. You have a really good performance, I think, by Peter Welch as the sergeant, who is a nice foil to the Algernon Bufinch character.
Yeah.
That's a good performance. There's really good acting across the board. The actor who plays Colin McLaren does a good job, even though he's in pain in literally every scene, getting injured early on.
Yeah. And as I said earlier on, it's Kirsty is played by a very young Hannah Gordon, who went on to have a very, very glittering career as an actress, very well respected in series like Telford's Change and in the 70s. She also appears twice on the Morecambe and Wise show, and that's you've hit the big time. You knew you'd hit the big time in the 1970s when you had an appearance on the Morecambe and Wise show. She sings, believe it or not, Windmills of My Mind, on their Christmas special in 1973.
I'm familiar primarily with the Jamie Harrison recording of that song. I didn't know that she had given it a go as well.
It's she's not bad. They do sort of like a comedy routine with it, but she's got a good singing voice. So I think this is one of her earliest performances, and she went on to have a very, very strong career.
And an interesting point about Peter Welch, who plays Sergeant Clegg. If you go to Peter Welch's Wikipedia page, the photo of him, the picture by which he is to be most remembered for posterity, having passed away 40 years ago, is a still photo of him in the Android Invasion. I'm sure of course, all the things he did, that is not the way he wishes to be remembered. But that is your Wikipedia for Peter Welch.
Of course, he's Mr. Morgan, the landlord, isn't he? Yes.
Yeah, he has a big part in part one and then sort of vanishes later on in the story. Mm-hmm. And David Garth, who plays the Gray, in every sense, Solicitor Gray, shows up again in a much more whimsical role in Terror of the Autons,
mm-hmm.
playing a Time Lord.
Yes.
And then you have Dallas, I think it's pronounced Cavell, but I'm not sure, Dallas mm-hmm. Cavell, as he was a recurring Doctor Who bad guy over the years. He has small bad guy parts in many, many stories. But I think Trask is probably the one where he's having the most fun.
Yeah. He's also, back to Ambassadors of Death again, he's James Quinlan in Ambassadors of Death, isn't he?
Yeah, I think that's probably his biggest Doctor Who part. He was in one episode of Dalek's Master Plan. He was in, I think, one episode of The Reign of Terror, famously getting bonked on the head by William Hartnell.
Mm-hmm.
He plays a very urbane civil servant who meets a bad end in Ambassadors. And then he plays a shouty security guard on location for Castor Valva, another one of my favorite stories. Yeah. So if I have a favorite Doctor Who story, it's likely that Dallas Cavill is going to have been an actor in it.
Yeah, he's a. I don't really know. I don't think I've ever seen him in anything else. And you know that, you know, through the sort of 60s and 70s, actors tended to, you know, to appear in lots of things. If you know, certainly. David Gray, who plays... Is it David Gray who plays Solicitor Gray?
David Garth.
He's David Garth, sorry. Yeah, he's also in a couple of episodes of The Avengers. I think he gets killed off in an episode called Wish You Were Here. And I seem to remember he was in a drama that was on tea time, lunchtime in the 1970s called Crown Court. He's got quite a sort of thin face, he's very sort of thin features. So I found him slow. I remember my mum watching it at lunchtime, and would sort of sit there and watch it with her and say, what on earth is all this going on? And he was sort of slightly scary, but sort of those actors that you'd sort of see sort of turning up in other things. And it's sort of small repertory company. A lot of actors in Doctor Who, sort of because they were cast by different by the same director. So you know, people like Dougie Canfield had the same sort of actors that he would cast on a regular basis. Yeah,
true. Like Ian Fairbairn. But speaking of other things, we're recording on Zoom. We have 5 minutes left, so I think we have time for a lightning round of 20 questions. Are you ready to play 20 questions?
I am ready.
You know the drill. What is your first question?
Is this story in black and white?
No, this is not a black and white story. We've ruled out the 1960s, so I am one Doctor Who story from 1970 to 2022. Question two.
Is this a new series story?
Yes, it is a new series story. You're a little more than halfway home. Question three.
Did this story air before 2013?
No, the story did not air before 2013. Question four.
Is it a Jodie Whittaker episode?
Yes, it is a Jodie Whittaker episode. Question five.
Does Bradley Walsh feature in this episode?
Yes, Bradley Walsh does feature in this episode. Question six. Not a lot of Bradley Walsh stories on 20 questions for Doctor Who literature, but this is going to be one of them.
Is it set in the past?
in a lawyerly fashion, I'll say no. The primary plot strand does not take place in the past. Question 7.
What's it called? Is it Can You Hear Me?
It is not Can You Hear Me. Question 8.
Is it from season 12?
Yes, or series 12? It is from series 12. Question 9. And I think now you're guaranteed to win because you have 12 questions left and there's less than 12 stories from that season. And multi-part stories count as one story for this show, of course.
Okay.
Question 9.
Do I start at the beginning and just work my way through? Is it Spyfall?
It is not Spyfall. Question 10.
Is it Orphan 55?
It is not Orphan 55. Question 11.
Okay, so
you're guaranteed to win, so I'll just give you a hint. You might be better off starting in the other direction.
Okay. Is it the Ascension of the Cybermen and the Timeless Children?
Yes, it is. It is. It is. I was happy to see that turn up on the randomizer.net because most of the stories that are picked for 20 questions randomly wind up being classic stories. But this is a new series, and it is a divisive new series story. So I'm glad to see it get its moment in the sun. It will never be the sole feature of Doctor Who literature unless a novelization eventually comes out. But if that happens, it's probably going to be many moons from now. So not a chance to talk about that too often. But here it is.
Yeah, the first episode is good. The second episode, I struggled with. I struggle with a concept of introducing a concept that will of sort of, you know, the history of the Doctor before the first Doctor that will baffle casual viewers and annoy diehard fans. But I can also see why they wanted to try and do something different and tie it in with the Fugitive Doctor. It's a slightly annoying that poor old Jodie ends up not really doing much in that second episode, but it's very well directed. The Cybermen are very, very scary. There's some good character moments for the regulars. And yeah, I mean, it's and the ending was quite surprising. So yeah, it's not a bad story. I haven't really rewatched it much, so maybe I should. I keep meaning to sort of sit down and watch series 12 again and give it another go.
Jodie spends an unfortunate part of both The Timeless Children and Power of the Doctor standing in front of a green screen getting mansplained to.
Yeah.
Which may have just been a logical requirement of the production season, but unfortunately it doesn't serve her character very well. While I am not a fan of the pre-Hartnell Doctor's concept, I think Twice Upon a Time does a much better job of establishing that, yes, William Hartnell is the first Doctor, and he left Gallifrey for a specific reason, and that's the whole point of what Twice Upon a Time is about. I think it can be done well, and since we don't know what RTD is going to do with that, there may yet be salvation in my mind for the whole idea of the pre-Hartnell Doctors. We may be seeing more of that to come. We'll give it an open mind. Daniel, we're about out of time. Thank you so much for your time today. Hope to see you again.
Unfortunately, Jason was cut off as our conversation was coming to an end. I guess it's his version of I'll take you to Blackpool. So thank you, Jason, for allowing me to join you to chat about the Highlanders novelisation and everything else. Despite the book being published nearly 40 years ago and the soundtrack being available, it still feels like one of those neglected stories which, despite the low stakes and the event it's connected with, is quite good fun. Guess they didn't have tone meetings back then. You can find me at DanielKnight73 on Twitter, or X as it's now called, now it's been elongated, and you can hear me on some of the Hamster with a Blunt Pen Knife podcasts with Joe Ford.
Doctor Who, The Highlanders, by Jerry Davis. Televised as The Highlanders. Teleplay by Jerry Davis. Screen credit to Jerry Davis and Elwyn Jones.
televised in December 1966 and January 1967. Paperback release date, November 15th, 1984. Target book number 90. Cover artist, Nick Spender. History books don't always tell the whole story. Certainly there is no record of an episode that occurred when the Scots, led by Bonnie Prince Charlie, were defeated by the English at the Battle of Culloden in 1746. And the presence at the time of a blue police box on the Scottish moors seems to have escaped the notice of most eyewitnesses. The Highlanders sets the record straight, and while the incidents described may not be of great interest to historians, for Jamie McCrimmon, they mark the beginning of a series of extraordinary adventures. For many years, I've been telling people that I started watching Doctor Who on Monday, November 23rd, 1984, when I saw those first 45 seconds of time flight that proved of no interest to me whatsoever. Looking at Google Calendar, and remembering firmly that I would have seen Caves of Androzani Part 4 on Friday, February 1st, 1985, I'm no longer quite sure that November date adds up, but it's close to being correct, which means that The Highlanders was the last novelization published before I became a Doctor Who fan. I would have picked the book up in late 1985. I only recall that, and as with my memory of when I first saw Time Flight, this memory may be slightly suspect, but I remember that I was in my first few months of middle school and was fascinated by the bizarre word spelled G-A-O-L. And I recall asking my 7th grade honors English teacher, Ms. Arnold, what that meant. Ms. Arnold passed away several months ago, as I write this. When I heard the news, my first memory was her telling me that Doctor Who novelizations were not advanced enough reading material to submit for in-class book reports. I chose Michael Crichton's The Andromeda Strain instead, which resulted in a C-plus grade, followed soon after by a phone call home to my parents about how my work was not on grade level, and I should be demoted to non-honors English. That call came when I was watching a rerun of Castrovalva Part 4 on PBS, and resulted in a stern talking to, prefaced by my parents summoning me upstairs with my full name, including my middle name. That's never a good sign. So in 7th grade, 1985-86, I certainly disagree that Doctor Who novelizations weren't, quote, advanced enough for book reports. The Highlanders confounded me, even apart from the British spelling of what I now know as the word jail. I didn't know anything about Scotland, or Inverness, the Jacobite Rebellion, the Battle of Culloden, the significance of 1746, all completely unknown to me. And possibly to Diana Gabaldon as well, as this is shortly before she chanced upon a PBS broadcast of the War Games, and likely found inspiration for her two most famous lead characters, from those played by Fraser Hines and Jane Sherwin. So I read Highlanders several times in the 80s, but it made little sense why Algernon Finch had two Fs in his name. I didn't understand the difference between lieutenants and sergeants, commissioned officers versus non-commissioned officers, what a standard was or why it was so important, or how you could drown in a prison cell. If only I'd known Daniel Knight in 1985, you see. After decades away from Highlanders, it came up again in my Random Order Target novelizations read-through. I mentioned this recently in episode 86, talking about the Dominators. That would have come up in late 2011 or early 2012. At that point, for the first time, the book delighted me. I'd aged into it. Now I understood everything. Well, mostly. By then I knew more about the layout of 18th century prison cells. I knew about Culloden and Inverness and standards. Heck, the villain in The Highlanders is a crooked lawyer using contracts signed under duress. That's the language I speak. I actively practiced law for over 15 years, and during that time I worked for or with half a dozen lawyers who got disbarred. Some of them most definitely worse than Solicitor Gray, that most mild of Doctor Who villains. After Highlanders was produced, Doctor Who stopped doing historicals, and the villain in the next televised story after this was Joseph First, which tells you a lot about why villains like Solicitor Gray were rarely used again. But in 2011, or 2012, I was delighted for the first time ever by the Highlanders book, and now I'm reading it again for the first time in over a decade. I'm now retired as a lawyer, but still directly involved in the profession, And now I know about Diana Gabaldon on Outlander 2, which I wouldn't have done a decade ago. So you're asking me, after this very long preface, how does the book land in 2023? I'm a big fan of Jerry Davis as a writer. I spoke earlier in episode 12, Doctor Who and the Cybermen, my first target, and episode 41, Doctor Who and the Tomb of the Cybermen, about how influential the books were for me, and how and why they worked better than their TV parents. But when I discovered those books, I'd been reading them out of sequence, both TV order and publication order. Now, in publication order, it's been about a year since I last read anything by Davis. How strange to see this titan from the lost black and white age, writing a book released just before season 22 aired. As it was released, Peter Howell's surging theme tune arrangement reached through the cathode ray tube in the New York City suburbs and dragged me out the other side to the fan I still am now, almost 40 years later. Of course, what's funny is, I first read this book 18 years or so after the Highlanders aired on TV, and when I read it, Highlanders already seemed like a lost relic. Today, 18 years ago from today, the last Harry Potter books were coming out, Christopher Nolan was hitting it big with Batman Begins. 18 years ago in 2023, seems like 45 seconds ago. As Daniel and I discussed earlier, Highlanders is an odd duck on TV, a mix of the grim horrors of war, the only surviving footage comes from the fight scenes in episode 1, and a comedy of manners, with fun had at the expense of Algernon Finch, or Solicitor Gray's nervous law clerk. Davis uses the novelization as an opportunity to smooth over the joins. Chapter 1 is told in reverse order of TV, the TARDIS lands first, before Alexander McLaren single-handedly takes on two redcoats, and Davis gives us largely original dialogue, with only a few stray lines faithful to what happened on TV. Davis does, as Daniel will have mentioned, give us a strong 7-paragraph essay on the history of Bonnie Prince Charlie and the disastrous war. When I was 11, literally the only words I understood from those 7 paragraphs were King and George. Being from the States, that was a name I'd heard. Davis characterizes the TARDIS regulars very well. The language Davis uses to describe the Second Doctor's outfit is basically taken word for word from the Moonbase novelization, almost a decade earlier in Davis's time. Shabby old frock coat, disreputable, rather baggy check trousers. In the book, Polly is a head taller than Ben, page 14, a whimsical notion not borne out by the historical record. Davis talks a couple of times about how Ben resents Polly's, quote, toffee-nosed attitude, and Polly resents Ben's overprotectiveness. Polly's long legs feature several times in the narrative. This is a 54-year-old author describing an actor who was 25 when the story was made, by the way. The Second Doctor's short-lived but frequently used signature line, "I would like a hat like this," is sadly deleted from the TV, but Davis replaces it with a full paragraph about the Doctor's love of hats. Bottom of page 14. The Doctor was very fond of hats. It was a standing joke in the TARDIS that he could never resist trying on any new hat he came across. This one was no exception. The Doctor pulled on the Tam O'Shanter and turned to the others. "How do I look?" he said. Chapter 2 has a bunch of other changes from the TV, some of Jamie's dialogue reassigned to Alexander. Colin wanted a Doctor on TV but was refused one in the book, and a long bit of expository dialogue is cut, which I play here mostly because it features the great William Dysart, who, as we'll get to when I finally reach my beloved Ambassadors of Death, is one of the things about that story.
Quick! Bring the redcoats upon us. They'll be here soon enough, have no fear.
The prince?
In a fashion, sir. He was the first to leave the field.
What's that you say about the prince?
Oh, stay the pair of you! Why didn't you leave me to die on the field?
You're the laird himself.
The laird of what? All the men of our clan are lying in the mud. I should be with them.
Oh, Kirsty, my Kirsty.
We may not be long joining them. The English troops are butchering all their wounded and hanging all their prisoners.
Can he hang us all, can he?
They'll not hang me, Piper. You may be sure of that.
Chapter 3 is much more faithful to the TV, except the Doctor Who. That's what I said. Joke is thankfully absent from the book. Probably funny in 1967, but I record this from the far side of the Stephen Moffat era. So no more Doctor Who jokes, please. The Doctor's pseudonym in the book is changed to Dr. Von Werner, which means protector rather than who. Solicitor Gray's introduction on page 25 portrays a one-dimensional villain, but it's a strong dimension. Solicitor Gray was sitting on the high seat of a supply wagon for the Duke of Cumberland's British Army. He had been watching the battle through a telescope, which he now shut up and placed back in a leather case beside him on the seat. He was a tall, thin man with a face the color of his name. In fact, everything about the solicitor was gray, from his mud-spattered coat to his long, lank gray hair, carefully held back in a bow in the manner of the period, and his long gray riding boots. His voice had the dusty echo of the law chambers and the penetrating edge acquired from years of pleading cases in court. There was a dangerous stillness about the man. He never allowed his feelings to get in the way of his business, and everything was considered in a purely logical light, without the softening shadow of ordinary humanity or human feelings. Davis weaves in a lot of period detail to help sell this for me as a historical, which is funny because Davis was part of the team that ended the pure historical seemingly forever, or at least until season 19. The sergeant, effectively played by Peter Welch on TV, we're told in Chapter 4, can't read, and his military pay is only 5 shillings a week. Less successful is Davis having Polly observe of Kirsty, on page 31, that 18th century women had, quote, more passive ways. The best historicals don't sneer at the past or gloat about how far society has come. That's reflected on TV, where Polly calls Kirsty a, quote, stupid peasant. In Chapter 5, Polly calls Kirsty, either in dialogue or internal monologue, both a wild, wailing peasant and a silly, weeping ninny. Later on page 46, Chapter 6, Polly observes that Kirsty does nothing but cry, and internally reflects on the difference between girls of the 18th and 20th centuries. Bearing in mind that Polly was an office worker while Kirsty worked on a farm and could wield weapons, not to mention building the animal trap in which Polly is later caught, 9 times out of 10, the real Kirsty is always going to have the upper hand. One other issue I had with the book as a youngster was, where did the cliffhangers go? In 1985, I was, of course, years away from online transcripts, or surviving audio, or crudely animated YouTube versions, or even loose canon. With Terrence books, you could divide the number of chapters by the number of episode parts, but this is a 17-chapter book, not divisible by 4. I then divided by page count, which got me to the bit on page 37, where Ben and the Doctor are separated from the TARDIS. That's not it. Come to find out, episode 1 ends on page 43 at the end of chapter 5. This is, in fact, one of the few targets I own where I never did mark off the cliffhangers, although I rectify that this month. And now I need a minute to stop giggling, because in episode 6, Finch threatens his men with 6 lashes apiece. Come to check the TV transcript, and on TV it was 300 lashes. OMG, you guys! Now, I had forgotten this, but turns out the discontinuity guide, 30 years ago, already discovered this, and listed it under goofs. Quote, Finch threatens his men with 300 lashes apiece. In the book, Davis alters it to a less terminal 6, end quote. And also in Chapter 9, page 65, Finch threatens Sergeant Clegg with a mere 10 lashes, altered from the TV script's much more terminal 500. 500. Episode 2 on TV has a ghastly pun about the word germs coming from German doctors, which, remember, the Doctor himself pretends to be in the first half of that story. Fortunately, that pun is taken out of the book for its corresponding material in Chapter 7. Chapter 8 features both Polly and the Doctor running circles around Finch and Solicitor Gray, respectively. I did think this material was a hoot when I was 11 or 12. Now I find it a little more exhausting than amusing. Under David Whittaker, the Highlanders could have been a meaty historical tragedy about the Battle of Culloden. Under Jerry Davis, it's Doctor Who's equivalent of one of Shakespeare's so-called problem plays. Is it a comedy? Tragedy? History? Just as I wasn't crazy about Davis constantly writing for Polly at the expense of 18th century Kirsty,
The story works less well for me if our two main leads, and make no mistake, Polly is second lead in this story, well ahead of Ben in the companion hierarchy, have such an easy time of it bamboozling and confounding our fictional 18th century guest characters. This historical could have worked better than it does, but at least the novelization is crisply told. Page 69, for example, Inverness Harbor is described as, quote, the cluster of tall masts that proclaim the river. I mean, how do you say mean things about a book with language like that? In Chapter 9, Davis appears to have changed his mind about the wisdom of having TV's most famous male time traveler dress up in drag as a Scottish serving maid. In the book, the Doctor inspects his new temporary costume, quote, with disgust. Davis does not preserve, from the TV version, for the book, a scene where the Doctor plays that serving maid in character.
All right, Fred, come on, let's move.
Officer.
Out of way, will you?
I've brought a wee drop of broth for Mr. Truss.
Oh, he's not here. I mean, he's gone. He's not here.
Well, you have it, officer. It's a pity to waste a nice hot broth.
Oh, all right. I'll have it. It's a cold night outside anyway. What are you looking at? He's only not there for two. Go on, get back to your post. Move!
Also deleted from TV is Pirate Captain Trask's habit of saying "arr" every 45 seconds. Now here's an arbitrary pirate fact. Historical pirates didn't say "arr." You can thank Robert Newton, using the West Country accent of his youth for the 1950 Treasure Island movie, for that bit of characterization. So the historical Trask, had there been one, this character is fictional, wouldn't have said "arr." And in fact, when Trask returns as a tertiary bad guy in Lawrence Miles' seminal 1997 BBC books Eighth Doctor Adventure Alien Bodies, he doesn't say "arr." So Trask's TV characterization by the great Dallas Cavill is indeed arbitrary. By the way, the previous paragraph about "arr" is taken almost word for word from the Sacagawea and Blackbeard episode of Netflix's awesome and sadly canceled The Who Was show. If you have kids at home, and if your country's Netflix carries The Who Was show's one season, highly recommended. While the Highlanders on TV does, as I said, have an odd shift between dark historical and whimsical farce, the novelization covers over this by paying attention to authentic-sounding historical detail. Although, as we learned from Kate Orman's audio essay on the Aztecs 2 weeks ago in episode 88, sometimes a book that seems to have authentic period detail is just making it all up out of whole cloth. But Davis's description of the Sea Eagle, the public house in Inverness where much of episodes 2 and 3 take place, gives the illusion of transporting the reader directly to 1746. Page 77, quote, the main dining room of the Sea Eagle was almost full, with a bustling crowd of soldiers and local inhabitants eating, drinking, and occasionally starting to fight before the two massive Highland serving men came forward to eject them. In the center there was a large fireplace with an ingle nook on either side. Opposite this there were rows of rough oak tables and benches at which most of the soldiers and townsfolk sat. On the far wall there was a succession of wooden partitions of tables and benches, affording some privacy to the occupants, who were able to pay for a complete meal instead of the hunks of bread, meat, and cheese favored by the less well-off customers at the inn. At the far wall were two huge barrels of beer, from which three soldiers were drawing large, foaming mugs. Every time they drew one, they made a chalk mark on the barrel, carefully watched by the proprietor of the inn, who was sitting at a table near the door, keeping an eye on the activities. There's also added detail in that chapter, Chapter 11, about Lieutenant Finch being a true ladies' man, while Perkins, the clerk, merely fancies himself one, page 81, quote, despite his years and egg-like appearance. Chapter 12 adds some nice details and turns of phrase. The Doctor, in his old lady's disguise, is mistaken by Perkins for, quote, a bundle of clothes. When the Doctor takes his nap at the end of the chapter, one of the few times on TV that the Doctor actually goes to sleep, rather than spending an episode unconscious or doubled by an extra wearing baggy check trousers, Polly and Kirsty join him. Page 92, quote, the two girls snuggle down in the hay beside the sleeping Doctor. Now there's some fanfic ideas for you. Davis continues to mock the slimy Perkins, though the uncalled-for dig at the man's height. Page 87, his fat jowls, quivering indignantly, stood up to his full 5'4". It is unfortunate, as height is not a personality trait and not under the control of the wearer. Even Charles Dickens understood that, in David Copperfield, as the short stature character points out, I didn't have a hand in the making of me. For those of you who like to track cliffhangers in books, part 3 falls on page 97, towards the end of, but not at the end of, chapter 13, amusingly titled A Ducking for Ben. Ducking. I assume Davis wrote this novelization on his cell phone, and the word ducking was an autocorrect error. Anyway, this is the only one of the three TV cliffhangers that Davis chooses not to place at the end of a chapter. Davis instead ends the chapter on an optimistic note. There's a really good description of how Ben escapes his ducking, using a Royal Navy sailor's trick and a variety of swim strokes, and the Doctor's Agent of Chaos costume as a British grenadier gives the chapter a happy ending, as he reveals all the weapons he's going to be smuggling out to the Highlander prisoners on board the Annabelle. Chapter 14 sadly removes the other instance of, I would like a hat like that. But it does include some character moments that Davis writes in to flesh out the narrative. Ben showing off his Houdini trick for Polly on page 101, quote, always enjoyed showing off for Polly. The opportunity for it came all too rarely. The Doctor on page 102 notes with some amusement that Kirstie is picking up some of Polly's fiery independent streak. Davis also gives Colin McLaren a nice waking dream when he hears Kirstie's voice from outside the boat. Page 106, quote, imagine his lovely young Kirstie running along the path to welcome him home. In chapter 15, Trask, our arbitrary pirate captain, is knocked off the Annabelle by Jamie, swinging across the deck on a rope, in a stunt that we lost when the videos were wiped and the foreign sale film cans were lost. The story ends in chapter 17 with Solicitor Gray arrested for his crimes and Polly planting a kiss on Lieutenant Finch. Davis cements their relationship with a moment not made explicit in TV dialogue when Polly returns the lieutenant's ID tag to him after having used it for blackmail for the previous three episodes. In the book, he allows her to keep a lock of his hair, which she'd also been using as blackmail, as a sentimental keepsake. Oh my word. That's a bit risque and blue. Looks like Polly's got herself a special fella. They must be engaged, as surely as if they were in pre-Columbian Mexico, and Lieutenant Finch had just made Polly some hot cocoa. Oh my word, oh my giddy aunt. Imagine that. A mid-20th century lass falling backwards through time, and then falling in love with an 18th century officer. Now there's a story for you. Next time on Doctor Who Literature, we are jolted back to the present. We are jolted back to season 21. It is the third and sadly final novel by one Christopher Hamilton Bidmead, and it is sadly the final time that Paddy Kingsland, the great Paddy Kingsland, wrote an incidental score for televised Doctor Who. It is the story that finally shows Peter Davison playing the Doctor he wants to play. It is a story where Mark Strickson gets to dial his intensity up to 11, if not 35. It is a story with dozens and dozens of witty one-liners. And come to find out, as a TV story, the episode's actually kind of pale in comparison to what's in the novelization. There's only one person who can join me to enthuse over this particular bit of Season 21 Classic. Welcome back next week to Doctor Who Literature, Mr. Cy Hart, as we travel to the far edges of the future and land on the planet Frontios. Thank you for joining me on another episode of the Doctor Who Literature Podcast. This podcast is produced by David Barsky, Jim Sangster, and yours truly. This week's episode was written and edited by me. Our logo was designed by Jim Sangster. Special thanks to my special guest, Daniel Knight. This podcast can be found on most of your podcast apps of choice. You can find all past episodes at podcasters.spotify.com/pod/show/Doctor Who Lit. It really helps if you rate 5 stars and subscribe. You can find me on Twitter at Doctor Who Novels, that's Dr. Who Novels, on Mastodon at Dr. Who Novels at mastodon.social, and on email at Doctor Who Literature, that's Dr. Who Literature at gmail.com. Please drop me a line with your comments, questions, and suggestions. Thank you for listening, and whatever you do, keep turning the pages.
Doctor Who Podcast Network.